I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Zadie Smith is the writer who likes to say she learns more from dancers, Fred Astaire to Michael Jackson, Baryshnikov to Beyoncé, than she gets out of writers and a lifetime of reading. It's the dancer's pull between the grounded, the floating, the real, the fantastic, that keeps shaking up the rhythm track under her new novel, Swing Time, as in the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movie of 1936. Her story begins with a pair of girls growing up in London in the 1980s, brown and biracial, like Zadie herself, testing their talents and drives, their devotion and rivalry in song and dance from New York to West Africa. But as Zadie Smith's story turns quickly to reflections on art, life, nation, power, girls, boys, race, and above all, the underclass and middle class lines that point most people to where they're going. This hour, we're picking up a conversation that began a dozen years ago around Zadie Smith's knockout debut novel, White Teeth, written at age 24 and still imagination's manual of possibilities among the young. I suppose we have to start with this book.
Right.
Swing Time. Girls, rivals, friends, mothers. So much of the ground felt familiar to me from Elena Ferrante.
Right.
Have you been asked about the Ferrante connection, these children in school who become lifelong mates and rivals?
Right. I was just reading I Am Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout, which was written at the beginning of this Ferrante thing. And I realized reading a lot of recent novels that they have this kind of influence of either Ferrante or Nausgaard. And partly it's a gift of freedom, right? It's just a different way of telling a story that releases you into your own. Yeah, I love Ferrante, but I guess I was thinking of a story that is more about power. I see Ferrante being about kind of intimate passions, and I was thinking more about the power between people, countries, the rich and the poor. And I suppose girlish friendship was the earliest example I could think of how those kind of power relations start.
Talk about it as power. I'm not sure I thought about it that way.
Well, for me it was a question of having certain gifts or human capacities that go unnoticed or wasted, which is obviously true of individuals but can be true of entire nations of people, no? And I was just interested in tracing that relationship, the idea that some people, their human capacities are exploited in the positive sense. They get to find out what their capacities are to use them in the world. And then there are huge swathes of people for whom that isn't true. And why isn't that true? And how does that come about? So for me, it was a novel about that.
So interesting that those girls don't know which powers they have, although it develops.
Right.
One is a dance girl, one
right.
is a song girl.
Right.
How did that happen?
My mind works in binaries a little bit, I guess. A lot of the novels I've written have those kind of a kind of binary at their center. It's not something I intend, it's just something that clearly my imagination goes that way.
Well, I'm thinking the narrator, never named, is Jamaican English. Her friend Tracy is Jamaican English of the opposite
right.
side. And the mother, especially the narrator's mother, Nefertiti, who becomes a member of parliament.
Right.
An extraordinary person. Can we sketch that triangle in terms of power, influences? Nefertiti's mama always had grand ambitions for her child.
Right.
Her friend's mother was a bit of a lowlife.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about the accidents of birth, you know. I was not the child of that kind of person, but I met lots of them as an adult, people whose parents were engaged in a larger battle, you know, who are political or activists or often, you know, on the side of the angels. But I was just curious about how that affects children, because children don't really care about your larger project. I mean, they might as adults later on, but in childhood, all they want is for you to be there. So I was quite interested in that tension. And I teach every year, I teach Kafka, and in Kafka's diaries, there's beautiful descriptions of what it's like to be in the shadow of such a parent. You know, his father was a similar type of person. There's a description of him. He had a dream that his father was lying across a map of the world, and only in the gaps where he wasn't lying could Kafka imagine existing. The book is full of people eclipsing other people, no? Just
right.
making them feel small, making them invisible, And that was the relationship I was kind of exploring.
Readers are fascinated that the narrator here, unnamed, is very much an I. And it is her story from inside in a way that White Teeth didn't have an I. As others have said, White Teeth had we.
Yeah. No, I wanted to write from the I, but I wanted to do something with the I, which I think is not generally done. Like my students, the young people I'm around, they're very preoccupied with the I because they write in it every day in their blog posts and emails and in all their presentations in Twitter on everything. And that kind of I is always very performative, right? The whole point is that you're demonstrating what a witty and interesting person you are, how complicated your identity is, and you want to be seen correctly for whatever your identity is. And I have been of the feeling for some time that those kind of identity politics, there's a limit to them. It's less important to me, for example, how people see me, how they categorize me, as than what my duties are and what my responsibilities are. So this kind of emphasis between rights and duties has been, for me, slightly askew. So I was trying to think of an I who almost doesn't exist, right? The only thing that she is in the world are her actions. And she finds out who she is from her actions, which I think is a very different way from a lot of young people have the conception that first you establish this glamorous identity, and then everything you do follows from that. You say, as a X, as a Y, and you imagine that you have some position of rectitude from that point. So I've been really interested talking to these first readers of the novel, because a lot of them are very disturbed by this empty I. But even aside from a kind of political argument, it's my feeling that when people are alone, when they don't have their phones, when they're not talking to their friends, when they're not in these kind of relations with other people, that it's quite hard to determine who you are, you know? Eyes only exist in relation, really. And it might be quite a useful feeling just for a moment not to be so concerned with your identity.
A couple of connections leap out there. For one thing, there's a wonderful anecdote that Fred Astaire, looking at his own movies, said, wait, he's not doing that quite right. Seeing himself objectively.
There's a kind of impersonality that I think I have always been interested in as a writer, and the character here is also interested in it. But it's something that's fallen very out of fashion. Now, there's an argument, a kind of moral argument, that because you did it, it is right. People feel that very strongly, that they proceed in rightness just because it's their subjectivity. And for me, that's a kind of dangerous misconception.
Second connection, I think of your marvelous piece on Barack Obama, the dream city notion that he, and in another way you, had entered a world of mixed identities in which there was something new called we.
Right.
You know, that's under siege now, in a fashion.
I think the kind of fluidity that Obama had in his person, which I find attractive in people generally, it's certainly the case that that has limits too, you know? Like, there were many moments during his presidency where groups of people, communities of people, wanted him to stand firmly in their camp and speak from one voice, and he's incredibly resistant to doing that almost all of the time. So in some senses, he was not the politician that people wanted. He is interested in incremental progress, in this kind of pragmatic politics, and that surprised a lot of people, I think, even though the clues in his personality were there from the start. But they perhaps wanted someone who would stand more firmly with them. And I don't know, maybe that is what people should have from their politics. But in terms of, you know, human people, he is somebody I admire a great deal.
Don't we all? Don't we all? But third point on the I connection. You read this favorite moment of mine in White Teeth when last we met. I love either you or I could read it again, but it's... This was written when?
I read it in 99. Yeah, it was published in...
99.
Well, 98, 99, yeah. It was published in 2000.
But there was this thing that always moved me. In the middle of the book, this has been the century of strangers,
brown, yellow, and white. This has been the century of the great immigrant experiment. It's only this late in the day that you can walk into a playground and find Isaac Leung by the fish pond, Danny Rahman in the football cage, Quang O'Rourke bouncing a basketball, and Irie Jones humming a tune. Children with first and last names on a direct collision course. Names that secrete within them mass exodus, cramped boats and planes, cold arrivals, medical checkups. It is only this late in the day, and possibly only in Willesden, that you can find best friends Sita and Sharon, constantly mistaken for each other because Sita is white, a mother like the name, and Sharon is Pakistani, her mother thought it best, less trouble. Yet despite all the mixing up, despite the fact that we have finally slipped into each other's lives with reasonable comfort, like a man returning to his lover's bed after a midnight walk, despite all this, it is still hard to admit that there is no one more English than the Indian, no one more Indian than the English. There are still young white men who are angry about that, who will roll out at closing time into the poorly lit streets with a kitchen knife wrapped in a tight fist. But it makes an immigrant laugh to hear the fears of the nationalist, scared of infection, penetration, miscegenation, when this is small fry, peanuts, compared to what the immigrant fears, dissolution, disappearance.
I haven't heard that in a long time.
Coming up, YouTube classic dance clips from the Nicholas Brothers, Sammy Davis Jr., Michael Jackson, and their revered Fred Astaire to keep a novelist and the rest of us in touch with the tragedy, the truth, the beauty of popular dance in our times.
So I was thinking about the difference between a dancer like Astaire or like the Nicholas Brothers and the kind of things that Beyoncé and a lot of the contemporary stars do. It's just interesting to me that they look like armies on stage. It's not like a chorus, it really is like an army, and they're facing you, and it's a very aggressive kind of position.
I'm putting on the top hat, tying up a white tie, brushing off my tails. Yeah, I'm duding up my shirt front, putting in the shirt studs, polishing my nails. I'm stepping out, my dear, to breathe an atmosphere that simply reeks with class. And I trust that you'll excuse my dust when I step on the gas, for I'll be there, putting down my top hat, mussing up my white tie, and dancing in my tails.
This is Open Source. Zadie Smith, prodigy in prose, but also wife, mother, and teacher now at New York University, takes heart in the United States. Whinging, she says, is a national pastime in England. Since the Brexit vote, she says the lazy liberals in London have been stuck in moaning mode, while her NYU students are already mobilizing on email chains, hunkering down to resist a siege. But then, as to roots of the distress here and there, Zadie Smith said this. Her father, in real life, was a downwardly mobile, white English man of the working class, cushioned by what was left of the welfare state. He was never desperate, never available to racism or hateful exploitation of his woes. In America, Zadie surmised to me, her father might well have been pushed to the curb into bankruptcy or disgrace or paranoia, who knows. And he might very plausibly have turned up in November 2016 as a Trump voter.
Well, I say again this thing of incremental progress. I also think that you can't expect deals that are made between government and the people to remain intact forever, you know? You are also in need of a new deal over here. And some of the compacts and agreements made between the people and government in England after the war are under great strain. I don't think that's unusual, just as I think that the right shouldn't imagine it can travel backwards in time. I also think the left has to be realistic and find new ways to approach new problems.
Yeah, we've put it on the radio, normalize, villainize, or mobilize.
Right.
Or move to New York.
Americans are very good at mobilizing. That part fills me with confidence. Incredibly organized, particularly the young. It might be a really interesting progressive moment. This is one minor silver lining.
What happened to that century of strangers? Kwame Leung in the playground.
Well, we're still in it. And for millions of people around the world, they still live like that. Part of the problem with this movement on the right is it's ahistorical. It tries to convince you that none of these things ever happened or ever could happen or ever will happen again. It's not true. So I think it's important not to join them in their hysteria. Neighborhoods all over the world where people are living like this have lived like this for many decades.
That was the beginning of your piece on Brexit. 3 months ago, only 3 months ago. And now everybody in America is trying to rewrite your
Brexit piece around Donald Trump, but you went back to the school you had attended and found, in a certain way, more productively multicultural and interesting, diverse, free, expressive than ever.
Well, at least in my neighborhood, the mixing hasn't gone away, but there is a separation of wealth that I feel has caused a lot of divisions. The poor are poor together and extremely racially mixed, but the rich are separating themselves, and have been for some while now. Their education system, their health system, where they live, how they live. Mm. And the gap of money has become quite obscene, at least in London, and I think all over America too.
Yeah. And everybody's houses in London are worth multiples of...
Yeah, extraordinary amounts of money. In Brexit, there'll be a correction. I mean, the houses will lose some of their worth, which I'm sure our friend John Lanchester would think was not a bad thing. You know, the inflation has been so extreme. Lanchester's written so well about what happened to London, this emptying out, the idea that property became a kind of place to park your money on its movement around the globe, forcing a lot of people I grew up with, to move out of London or move to the borders and to recreate the kind of situation you see in Paris, where people live in kind of banlieues and the city is kind of heritage site and protected for the very rich. That's a tragedy for London, but we'll see. Things are changing now.
You told that wonderful story about a woman in a playground. Your child and hers knew each other in school. She looked at you in a kind of curious, shy, but friendly way. And the question was sort of, when will we meet? But the play date never happened, as you wrote.
No. And I'm sure that's my fault or my projection, but that was part of what I was trying to write about, that when your institutions don't encourage you to mix with people in a daily way, a lot of suspicion rises between communities. Well, the comparison I draw with America is just the idea that we have paid so much attention to ideas of identity, really, rather than arguments of class, that certain very obvious things we've missed. And even these books I've been writing for years, every time I do interviews, people ask me, describe them as books about the search for identity and et cetera, et cetera. I have never thought of them that way. To me, they're about exactly the kind of irrelevance of identity in people's intimate and political lives. Mm. Class, to me, is the thing which is the most significant, because class determines what you can do with your life. My books are certainly about the idea that you could be born in a certain postcode and that will determine to a certain extent your future. But that's a question of class and of economics. And I don't know, certainly in this American election, not enough attention was paid to those issues.
But that lady in the playground you wrote in your Brexit piece was not put off by question of color or identity, but by class.
Yeah, that was my feeling. Because in those projects in England, race mixing is not the problem. They're very racially mixed, but they are uniformly poor. That is a dynamic which seems to be more significant right now.
Back to Swing Time and the unnamed narrator and her marvelous mother. Her mother was always suggesting in many, many ways that this is not reality. Reality is what you're heading toward, and it's going to be different. It's going to be remarkable.
Right.
And her friend, Tracy, didn't have that. It was almost exactly the opposite. Account for the mother's dream.
Well, I think someone like that woman, she is remarkable. But the question is, why should you have to be remarkable to reach a perfectly middle-class life? Middle-class people don't need to be remarkable to do that. Often they're perfectly mediocre in every way. The mother in that book is unprecedentedly forceful, willful, smart, and she has to do... put so much effort in just to tread water. And that really is the question. Why do we have to work so hard to reach a level which for other people is just a matter of birth?
Is there an answer?
Well, yeah, it's called being part of a permanent underclass. And the kind of deal that is made in England, that if you study hard, you can break through, that is a good deal. Not that the other children study anywhere near as hard, but say it was a fair deal. Even that deal now is no longer in existence, you know?
How different is it living in New York? I mean, what do you observe about us as opposed to that permanent underclass thing?
For me, it seems very similar. Maybe I see things through the same lens, but the thing I find extraordinary sometimes when I'm in New York is the willful blindness of people as they move through the city. So I have never heard anybody mention, for example, in the village in which I live, that every Starbucks, every cafe, every retail place is stocked exclusively with African-American young people who are college age and presumably should be in college. Nobody seems to find that at all unusual. Or do they think that the kid is passing through and he'll be gone in the summer? And then when they see him year in, year out in Pret or McDonald's for the next decade, that seems to be a perfectly reasonable situation for New Yorkers. And there's nothing strange about it. In fact, it's impolite to mention it. But I notice it, maybe because I'm British, and it seems surprising to me that certain classes of work are reserved for different racial groups.
Yeah. You remind me of my friend Ganzir, first among the Arab Spring graffiti artists, geniuses in Cairo, who came to New York. And he observed, among other things, on the subway, not Starbucks, the African-Americans, the third worlders. First, he said, they're not Americans, you know. They don't think of themselves as Americans, and you don't regard them as Americans.
Well, maybe I think when you come from a different country into America, what you notice is that in these urban centers, when you see African-American kids no further along in this economic battle than the very recent migrant, you have to ask why. Because African-American kids are as American as it's possible to be. They built this country.
Of course.
So there must be something going on in the system which makes it very difficult for people to move forward.
People are rewriting you to explain Trump for so many good reasons, but you looked at the Brexit vote and saw a movement driven by stupidity with a touch of genius too. And this is what we're trying to account for now.
I think that longing that everybody has, I have it too. Everybody has a dream of someone who will just speak like a human. And he does that. He speaks.
I said that to my kids. I had taken a trip, observed a lot of different people, baggage handlers, people on buses, blah, blah, blah. And I said to my kids, say what you will about Donald Trump, he speaks American.
Right.
And they rebelled. What are you talking about? That's not American.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. It was frank and funny and non-formal, and Americans are not formal in their hearts. People must be so desperate to hear something which sounds to them authentic. Obviously, layers of Trump are so inauthentic, it's ridiculous. But his speech was very powerful, I think. Engaging in some way.
Yep. One thing, he never got tired.
No.
And he never broke out of character either.
No. I don't think there is anything going on behind the scenes. He's not. I don't think he's Machiavellian in that sense, and that was also a great thing in his favor.
You wrote in the case of Brexit that there was also just a huge pleasure in tipping over the system, and not just the newspapers or the establishment, but the system. And you called it this word we're not supposed to even to know, much less define, neoliberalism. And you said that a notable feature of neoliberalism is that it feels you can do nothing to change it. Well, they did.
Yeah, the vote is the last place of people power in that system. So the perversity of it, Dave Eggers, when he went to visit a Trump rally, mentioned this element that there were people who really were thinking, well, wouldn't it be funny to see Trump and Angela Merkel? And they're correct, it will be hilarious. It'll be very entertaining. And then it'll be unbelievably dismal for us all. That was a large aspect of it, I think. A kind of deep perversity and desire to bring on some kind of chaos, to break the stagnation.
Can you define neoliberalism, or what people were voting against in Brexit and in our election?
I think it's unprotected capital. It's where capital is given priority over everything. It moves fluidly around the world. And some of the structures we used to use to protect people, given that people will not always be on the right side of the deal, in Trump's language, they will not always be the winners in that deal. Things like unions, things like healthcare, things like welfare protection were being chipped away at until there was nothing left but this argument of capital, in which people go to the wall. Part of the problem of neoliberalism also is we emptied out the political language for that protection. So even people who went to the wall would speak to your face the language of neoliberalism, say, well, if you can't win, you fail. Well, you're not going to get some welfare, you welfare queen. It happened in England as well. The language of Thatcherism gave working class people a kind of tool with which to wound themselves.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think of Hillary Clinton saying, education shouldn't be free. Kids should have, what did she say? Skin in the game.
Right.
Meaning, to me, I define liberalism simply as a policy that counts on young people, wonderful minds, spirits, bodies, to save us But by the way, you've got to carry a couple hundred thousand dollars of debt on your back as you do it.
Right. And it chips away at the idea of any element of life being a kind of a relational gift, like the idea of education being free, healthcare being free, the philosophical basis of those arguments that they are rights, human rights that accrue to people, has been demolished. So that people even on the left don't know how to defend the idea of the right to education and the right to healthcare.
Yeah. I keep rereading Tony Judt's Ill Fares the Land. Do you know that book? Amazing book. He was Jewish from Eastern Europe, grew up in London in the 70s, I think. And what was it about? It was free public transportation, free public education, free public health.
Right.
Throw in housing, and you've got a package. And he said, the tragedy of our moment is we're kissing that goodbye.
Right.
Almost willingly. We've been conned into letting the social democracy go.
Right. But I also think that the generation of social democrats in England were naive, thinking that they'd established a permanent compact.
Right.
There was no reason in 20th century history to think such a thing was ever true. We had two cataclysmic world wars, and this is our version of the third one. It's fought differently, obviously, but I didn't see why we should be a generation who escaped it. And that was true on both sides. Those books like The End of History and The Last Man, Fukuyama's book, predicting the end of human history. That's basically what they thought it was. It was going to be a liberal economy, a basically reasonable kind of democratic compact between the people. The end of religion, that was another big one that people were so sure. Goes against what we know about humans going back thousands of years. So it's ahistorical in some sense.
Tony Judt also wrote about, he just wrote about money worship, really a Tower of Babel kind of scene. And he also spoke about our dilapidated public conversation. I mean, these are my three touchstones of sort of the diagnosis.
Right. Well, we know that when countries with extreme gaps of wealth and poverty are, by most measures, more miserable when they are surveyed, and people who are contained within this compact, not in the extremity of, you know, communist Russia, but Denmark, Norway, Sweden, when there are, in some sense, limits to how far our greed can go, people express larger contentment. But to make that case to Americans, I think, is impossible. It's never been part of your idea of your democracy. So that's not to be hoped for, but something a little more reasonable.
It's never been part of the public conversation. But you know that guy, Dan Ariely, Predictably Irrational? I mean, he's done simple questionnaires, you know, showing people five, you know, circle graphs divided in different ways. Would you like to live in this one where the benefits are distributed in such and such a way? And which one is ours? Nobody recognizes the world we live in.
Right.
In which, you know, almost half the people live with nothing or next to nothing, et cetera. But the one people choose, 92% of Republicans, 93% of Democrats, he said, they choose the one that is in fact Sweden.
But they don't want to hear the name Sweden, yeah.
And we're continually warned against, oh, that creeping, you know, scandal socialism. But he would say, no, blindfold test, that's what people want.
Right. But there's really been no language to express it in America. But the fact that it has become possible, like in those Piketty studies, to find people who, I have one of them in my novel actually, whose wealth equals the GDP of entire countries. And not a few people, many, many people. It's a situation of extremity that the world's never really seen. You have to go back to ancient Rome to deal with these kind of inequalities of wealth. That didn't end well either, by the way, that whole scenario.
We love Mary Beard, and we've talked to her from time to time. And the first time, we were just talking about her book, and she was talking about the second century, Tacitus time, but really about, she said, you know, it was coming down to a few families, a few oligarchs, vast wealth, a degradation of language, an elevation of sex. And I listened to it 6 months later and I thought, wait a sec, aren't we there?
Right.
Isn't that us? We asked her again and she said, she was lecturing in New Haven and she said, well, yeah, it looks familiar.
It's getting there, yeah. And there are smaller examples like Italy as well in recent times has this rise of oligarchy, this obsession with sex, this degradation of language. And even Berlusconi once, I read somewhere when I was living in Italy that he's planning his mausoleum with great detail. Not that he thinks he's going to die anytime soon, but he imagines this huge gold coffin and he'll be embalmed in some way. And yeah, you know, really like Caesar type delusions. But then the lesson of Rome is that there will be some kind of cataclysm. And knowing that the many things that Trump wants cannot happen.
True.
I mean, the thing which concerns me almost more than anything is some of the things he promised, particularly his non-interventionist stance in the rest of the world, which in some senses is a positive thing, right? The idea of not starting preemptive wars all over the Middle East. But that's going to leave him with nowhere to go but internally. So the people who are going to feel the most pain, I feel, are other Americans. If you have that law and order platform but you can't go and bomb Syria, what are you going to do? It's going to be the police.
Well, remember you said that. I hope you're wrong.
Yeah, me too.
You remind me of Simon Sharma yesterday. I said, Simon, who would you have sit next to this man, Trump? And not patronize him, but say, coach him. And he thought a moment. He said, Charles Dickens, I'd want him to read, give him a Christmas Carol reading of the man who, Ebenezer Trump.
Yeah, well, he's quite sentimental. That might work. Yeah.
Well, Simon said, oh, but then he doesn't read anything but the National Enquirer. And I thought after, but Scrooge didn't read anything.
No.
He was visited by a ghost and a spirit. And he woke up a new man. Is that crazy?
Yeah. My only feeling about him really personally is that he's so far from himself that it's really hard to work with someone like that who's such a stranger to himself in so many ways.
Right.
It's like dealing with a child, really.
Coming up, Zadie Smith's spontaneous train of thought when she heard a young black woman on a New York subway declaring for all to hear why she voted for Donald Trump. This is Open Source. Listening to Zadie Smith on the open rules of global capitalism and the social effects of what is called neoliberalism, I'm reminded of the Indian novelist and anthropologist Amitav Ghosh telling us recently about the whirlwind power of liberated investment money in China, drawing young workers for a generation now out of their villages to coastal factories, leaving children and grandparents behind in a society that had family at the core of its ideals and its ancient practice.
I think it hollows out societies. Like when I was young, we weren't aware of it because we were just coming out of college, but I do remember thinking it strange that we'd all gone to this very prestigious university for free. We were all so privileged and we could do anything. And then you got to graduation day and you suddenly started realizing that all these people you've been in ancient Greek classes with and English classes and all kinds of interesting classes, at least a third of them were about to go straight to the banks. No one had mentioned that in 3 years.
Yeah.
But all the banks came in the last few weeks of graduation, put up their stalls, and suddenly everybody was gone, banks or corporate law. That is just a tragedy. I was taught myself in my high school by a man who went to King's College, Cambridge, who taught English in my very wild school. But that was 35 years earlier, you know, when it seemed a reasonable enough thing to leave a place like Cambridge and think, right, I want to be a high school teacher. I don't think I knew a single soul at Cambridge who became a teacher, not a soul. And so that generation in the 90s was very different from the one that came before. And the reflection, we saw what happened in English life. Cambridge and Oxford ruled a certain kind of professional life in England, and that professional life went to the city. And then England became a country of the city, in fact.
Well, in this country, it's an effect, surely, of saddling young graduates with
$100,000,
$200,000 of debt.
Right. But you don't need to do that in England. You just needed to tell them how much they were going to make in 2 years. And they were making more than my parents made in a lifetime, age 24.
Speak about mobilize, and especially what you learned from Americans, your American students, kids in their 20s who powered Bernie in New Hampshire. What are they teaching you, I wonder?
I read this piece this morning by Mark Liller in the Times about the end of identity, liberal identity politics. I have thought for some time that when my students want to talk for a very long time about transgender bathrooms but don't want to talk about how they got to NYU through private schools, $60,000 a year, nobody wants to talk about that. I've thought for a while that not that their questions of personal identity are not important, but the question is how important are they? It's a question of proportion. And if they become the only thing that anybody wants to talk about, it's a problem. But I think the Bernie movement was really positive because that really was about structural inequality. He was bringing them something that they hadn't really had, which was a language for their actual political situation. And Bernie himself was not too interested in transgender bathrooms or any of the rest of it. He wanted to talk about money over and over and over again. And I think that's a very good influence. And then I just feel, I guess, I have an admiration for all my students and the young people I meet in America is just how organized they are. Like the response to Brexit, amongst me and my friends and my younger family is just to moan, basically. We go into moaning mode. For the day after the election, I was on these endless email chains of young people organising, rights lawyers, activists, labour lawyers, writers, like endless, and they're going to meet on the weekend. They've got all kinds of plans and they know how the Supreme Court works and they know what to block. And I think that's kind of extraordinary in American life, that people are so knowledgeable about their government one way or another and they want to do something. So I feel quite positive, really.
From the ridiculous to the sublime, I'm dying to ask you about dance and dancing, starting with, you know, in the middle of the night when you wake up and want to see Fred Astaire, where do you go? Or Beyonce, for that matter, or Michael Jackson.
There's a nice Fred Astaire routine, Isn't It a Lovely Day? I guess maybe it's Berlin or Porter, I don't remember the song. I think it's in Top Hat, where it's raining and he and Ginger are under some kind of covering in the park, like a parade ground, and they do a lovely dance to that. But I mean, I can watch any bit of Fred. Is very it's happy making for me.
The weather is brightening, the thunder and lightning seem to be having their way, but as far as I'm concerned, it's a lovely day.
Do you like Begin the Begin with Eleanor Powell?
Yeah, beautiful.
Blows my mind every time. This is a little risky, but do you like Dancing in the Dark with Sid Charisse?
Yes, I do. Though Sid Charisse is such a kind of dramatic dancer, it's hard to focus on them both at the same time. I don't know. To me, they're a slightly strange pairing. I like Sid Charisse with Gene Kelly, athletic.
Then you remind me, maybe my favorite is Sammy Davis Jr. imitating Fred Astaire's walk. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
When he walks down the street, just to see him walk down the street is worth the price of admission.
I think I didn't end up putting it in the book, a little film called Rufus Jones for President, which is this incredibly racist short from like 1942 or something, with Sammy Davis, he's 8 years old, and Ethel Waters is his mother, and Ethel dreams that her son becomes president, first black president of the United States. So you see little Sammy in the Congress and he's tap dancing, and all the senators are black, and of course all they want to eat is pork rinds and watermelon. It's the most offensive thing. But it's such a curious thing because it's kind of like a dream world where this black man is president of the United States. And Sammy himself in it is spectacular. He dances so wonderfully and is so full of energy. And there's all these great black singers and artists in it, trapped in this horribly written, cruel, it's a really cruel short piece, ridiculing even the possibility. I was really fascinated by it. I ended up not putting it in the book, but it so spoke to the tension I was thinking about of these great artists trapped in this rancid form, you know, where they had to do their best in a context that must have been painful to them.
Could do that.
I've never seen it.
It's called Rufus Jones for President. I think you can see the whole thing on YouTube. It's only about 15 minutes long, if that.
Last one for me is Fred in the Dark Room with Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah. Now, I mean, Audrey can't really dance, but it doesn't matter. She can't sing either, but that doesn't matter.
Well, they said Fred couldn't sing, but he was a wonderful singer.
Yeah, he really could sing. But it's taken me a long time, I think, to understand what a great singer he was. It's about interpretation rather than power. And the songwriters thought he was great too and loved him singing those songs. He has a beautiful way with the song.
Yeah.
I love your funny face. Your sunny, funny face. You're not exotic, but so hypnotic.
I've listened to you forever on dancing and writing. Dancers and writers. What is it?
So I was thinking about the difference between a dancer like Astaire or like the Nicholas Brothers and the kind of things that Beyonce and a lot of the contemporary stars do. It's just interesting to me that they look like armies on stage, which is very different from my idea of a dancer. It's become normal to have whoever it is, Katy Perry or Beyonce or whoever. It's not like a chorus. It really is like an army, and they're facing you, and it's a very aggressive kind of position. And it's all about a kind of vigorous physical display and everything being done perfectly. So they all imitate this person in front. And I was just interested in it, what it means to be in a stadium with millions of people watching this almost militaristic display, even if it's on the side of, you know, goodness, Beyonce's lovely, everyone loves Beyonce, but it's still the structure of it seems to me very much about this moment rather than if you'd gone and seen a vaudeville show in, you know, 1944. Hmm. Something almost corporate in the mentality.
And look but don't touch, maybe, or not an inclusive.
Yeah, it's very, the whole point of Beyonce, that's why so many people admire, is that she's completely impervious. Like, there's nothing you can do to touch her. When you say queen or goddess, that's what you mean. But I don't know if that's something that a human should aspire to as a quality.
Hmm. You also wrote wonderfully about Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Another Esther freak.
Yeah, I love Jackson. I mean, I grew up with him, and my whole generation did. And I suppose he had a particular relation to black children who saw him. Like, I was always struck to remember my mother came from a large family, and they used to watch the Jackson Five, you know, sure. And feel, as I think a lot of kids of that generation did in the 60s, deep connection with these kids as if they were dancing for you. My generation got Michael, and of course we had to, you know, we had to go along with him during this extremely painful journey. I have to say, personally, I'm not one of the people who believes he had some kind of mysterious skin disease that nobody's ever had before or never looks like that on anybody else. I take the conclusion that seems to me obvious. And so it was a very painful thing as a child, I think, to watch this person that you had been given as not only as a musical hero, but really as a kind of god, you know, the god of our people and a great example, the great success of black American life. Do what he did to himself. That's a very peculiar message to give to children.
But what did he die of?
Well, he seems to have died of drug abuse, but I do not feel that his skin turned white from vitiligo. We have all seen that disease, and it doesn't look like that. And that also does not account, of course, for his nose, his chin, his cheeks, his eyes, the multiple surgeries that he performed on his face so they had no negroid aspect left. You know, even if you put the skin aside, it was a painful, painful process.
But remember him as a dancer, which I want to do.
Well, so do I. That's the bit I love about him. But I guess it's always the question of trying to retain that love in the face of all this pain, his pain as well, right?
Yeah.
He was so filled with pain. But he's one of the greatest dancers who's ever lived. He was such a great dancer that even people who would have every right to turn from him, discuss Spike Lee and a whole generation of pop stars, can't, because he was that good. I think that's an amazing amount of good to be. He was the best.
It's always on my mind, this, in the identity context and in the Kwame Leung context, the culture we live from jazz to post-hip-hop is all a product of these two migrations, African-Americans out of Jim Crow and Jews out of Eastern Europe and Germany. And it's where, you know, Arthur Schwartz and Dancing in the Dark came to, well, in this case, Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse, but it's Coltrane and My Favorite Things by Richard Rodgers, and it's Charlie Parker doing Gershwin or Miles Davis or all of these things. It seems to me, I'm getting old, but it's the most precious thing in the world I grew up in. And how do we, you know, just affirm it, remember it? This is what made our taste.
Well, I think some things really help, like institutional recognition, things like the African American Museum now in Washington. Yeah. I don't think it's lost on either black community or the Jewish community, this long interrelation, strange, loving, adoring relationship that is also at the political and practical level full of problems and has always been problematic at the same time. But our cultural products together are the glory of American life, I agree. But I don't think America is ignorant of that. It's one of the first things I knew about America before I came here, that these two communities had flowered together, worshipped each other, particularly in jazz, right? Jazz is the place where back and forth they go as musicians and critics speaking to each other and creating this thing together. As long as historians attend to it and remember it, I don't think it's ever forgotten that American culture lives there.
We do know it. My favorite instance might be Ira Gershwin, who outlived George, saying, "We didn't know how good the songs were until I heard Ella Fitzgerald sing them."
Right. Or and Porgy and Bess, which is, you know, a black slave musical written by two white Jewish guys sung by some of the best black singers in America. It's a complex relationship, and like now you think, what arguments of appropriation would it be under? To me, it is a kind of love letter, but that doesn't mean that it's pure. I think love is full of complications, as anybody knows who's ever been in love. So that's how I think of it. I don't think it's pure and simple. I think what came out of it is so full of joy.
You wrote so wonderfully about Obama, the manipulator of language and of borders, as you are, coming into the office. You had some reservation as to whether that good a writer really ought to be in such a place of power. Speak your mind on Barack on the way out.
I retain my great admiration. I think it was interesting to me to see so many of the Rust Belt states. I guess you feel it like it's a repudiation of the legacy. And I heard the next day on the subway a young black girl speaking very loudly in New York on the train explaining why she voted for Trump. And one of the reasons was he didn't give us any jobs. There were no jobs. He gave us less jobs than Bush, which is one of those Facebook facts, which is not actually accurate. But anyway, it's how she felt. And I thought about the problem with Obama's presidency was so much of it is counterfactual. So it's hard to just say to people, well, if it wasn't for that bailout, there would have been 800,000 less jobs. You know, it was counterfactual. It was a rescuing and a protection of something that I think the left never managed to convey how much had been saved, that 2008 should have been apocalypse in America. And instead, it was just very, very bad. But without his rationality, reasonability, pragmatism, patience, persistence, it could have been so much worse. Whoever sold that to an electorate, and by the way, it could have been so much worse.
Yeah. And yet so many people, maybe me, feel there was a turn to be made there. And he didn't make the turn,
yeah.
Especially on the war in Iraq.
Right, and the drones, of course.
And the drones, and the neoliberal thing.
Yeah.
Larry Summers rule, the whole bit, the banks, the triangulation.
Yes, he allowed it to happen. I think he's kind of non-ideological. He listens to the smartest person in the room, which can sometimes be a problem because that smart person can be the ideologue. But no, he was not a perfect president, but I think more and more about being thrown into a presidency, and you come with a certain set of ideas, and then there's the daily life. I imagine, you know, something happens in Minnesota, there's a disaster here, a bomb goes off there. So something happens, and you have to react. I didn't think until you've seen Trump react day in, day out to those things, not the things you go into presidency thinking, I'm going to do this, but what actually happens, the rolling events. When you've seen Trump respond to a year worth of those, I think the greatness of Obama might be clearer. Because when something happens in Miami, he doesn't send the National Guard out onto the street. The police aren't there. People aren't dragged from their homes. Again, it's a counterfactual. It's about the things that somebody doesn't do. But I think you're about to see somebody do things in response, the way that Trump responds to things so quickly, irrationally, with such fury. Then you might see more clearly what a reasonable man we've lost.
And what of the writer inside that president? What do you expect of him now?
Well, the signs, as far as we are concerned in the literary community, are very good. We hope that he will move to New York and continue writing and being interested in writing, as he seems to be. But I can completely see that there will be many other people, the activist people, the people interested in change in Africa and change in Europe, who will want him for other causes, and I'm sure he'll go there. But he's very welcome to come to New York and talk about books. All day long.
He'll be very glad to hear it, I'm sure. Zadie Smith, it's a joy to see you and listen again.
Thanks. Thank you.
Swing Time is Zadie Smith's big new novel. Our conversation was produced by Mary McGrath and Connor Gillies with help from Susan Coyne, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. George Hicks mixed the program. I'm Christopher Lydon.
Sign up for our newsletter, full of Zadie pictures this week. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And by all means, join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.